From the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, this is Politically Georgia. I'm Patricia Murphy. Today, a new law will make it easier for activists to file mass challenges to other voters' registrations in Georgia. State Representative Syra Draper will tell us why that and a new artificial intelligence tool have her worried.
I'm Greg Bluestein. The time-honored tradition of candidates participating in debates is falling by the wayside in a number of Georgia races. We'll tell you which high-profile incumbents have rejected invitations from the Atlanta Press Club to debate and talk with the Press Club's Lori Strauss about the impact of their decisions not to face their opponents.
I'm Bill Nygut. Plus, Fani Willis is no longer the only state prosecutor to have filed criminal charges in the Trump effort to overturn the 2020 election. Trump's election denier associates now face criminal indictments in Arizona.
We invite you to follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode of Politically Georgia.
Ocean breeze, tropical beach, piña colada. You can buy an air freshener to make your car smell like you're in an oceanside paradise. Or, better yet, you can point your car toward Daytona Beach and come experience the real thing. Visit DaytonaBeach.com to discover all there is to see, do, and enjoy along the world's most famous beach, Daytona Beach, Florida. Beach on.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome back to the AJC's Politically Georgia. I'm Patricia Murphy, here with Greg Bluestein and Bill Nygut. Well, guys, I usually see you in the radio studio on Thursdays, but today we're taping a podcast-only edition of the show because NPR is taking live coverage of the Trump immunity case already underway in the Supreme Court. Live broadcasts of Politically Georgia will resume tomorrow on WABE in Atlanta. Bill, have you been following all of these court cases this week for Trump?
Yeah, of course. And we've already talked about this, as have many, many people in media. It's unfortunate that we can only follow the New York case by getting reports from the courtroom from reporters who are able to watch what's going on. But people can be listening today to the audio of the arguments in the Supreme Court immunity case. And I'm frankly can't wait to listen to those later when they're available on tape.
I know, Greg, look at the Supreme Court outdoing the New York court system in terms of just like a live stream of all the information you need on a Trump case.
At least there's audio, as opposed to the New York case where there's no cameras allowed in the courtroom at all. All we have is illustrations and live feeds from reporters. But thank goodness for Fulton County, you know, where we can watch everything, every hearing from the most minute to the biggest development through a live stream, cameras in the courtroom.
I know, and I'm no artist, but I feel like even some of the drawings coming out of the court have a bit of editorial messaging happening.
I noticed that too. I noticed yesterday a drawing of Trump looking very, very evil, and one of his attorneys also looking very evil, whispering conspiratorially into his ear.
I would like to see with my own two eyes. I want to decide.
You can almost pick
if
up
I see
on
conspiracies.
The odor of mendacity in that.
Yeah, exactly. But you have to be in the courtroom to smell the odor of mendacity. All right. Well, we'll keep you updated on that story and others, of course. But here in Georgia, our next election is fast approaching in the May primary. And before that, the Atlanta Press Club is going to sponsor debates in the competitive races where they have the candidates coming in and some candidates not coming in. And here to discuss that with us is the executive director of the Atlanta Press Club, Lori Strauss. Lori, thanks for being here.
Good morning, everyone. And just a quick correction, I am not the executive director, but I am the organizer. I'm the past executive director, but I right now just organize the Atlanta Press Club debates for them.
Lori, I'm here to take you backward and give you more responsibility than you wanted in the first place.
No, I've done my time there. So.
Okay, but you certainly have a leadership position, certainly in these debates that are coming up. And it's a really unusual situation for the Atlanta Press Club, because you and I have been talking about this. I also discussed it with Maria Saporta, who everybody knows Maria Saporta. If you don't know who she is, veteran Atlanta journalist, longtime AJC-er. She now has the Saporta Report. She's also a co-founder of this debate series for the Press Club.
Correct.
And the situation you find yourselves in is that as of today, you have no incumbents coming to these debates for the first time that anybody can really remember.
Yeah, it could be the first time ever, but certainly in recent history. But we are doing a total of 7 debates that'll be taking place on Sunday. And as of now, those races include, 4 of those races include incumbent candidates. And as of today, none of those incumbents have told us that they would be there to participate.
Okay, well, to get this conversation started, I'm going to read a bit of a statement that the Press Club put out this morning about exactly what's going on with these incumbents. It says, while we're delighted that so many have confirmed their participation in the upcoming debates, the Atlanta Press Club, at the Atlanta Press Club, none of the incumbents in the debates we're hosting plan to participate at this time. They have all officially declined or have yet to confirm their participation. This is the first time in the history of our debate series that so many incumbents have failed to take part. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. If a candidate is running for public office, the candidate should be willing to participate in the democratic process, which includes attending debates and fielding questions from journalists and opponents. And in the place of these incumbents, y'all are planning to have an empty podium.
That is correct. It has been a long time policy for the Atlanta Press Club debate series that if an incumbent isn't there, we do still hold the debate. We do have an empty podium to let the voting public know that someone was invited and chose not to be there.
Okay, Greg, you've been a part of these conversations. Jump into the conversation.
Yeah, full disclosure, I'm a member of the Atlanta Press Club Debate Committee, so we've been engaged in some of the back and forth behind the scenes. And Lori, from what I understand it, this year it's interesting because some of the candidates have said, yes, I'm not coming, but others have not issued an answer yet. And look, in part, and I'm just here analyzing, I'm not asking you to say yes or no, but in part, it's because they're able to avoid those negative stories saying they're not participating in the debate because it's not on the record for them saying no to these debates.
Yeah, that's correct, Greg. We never speculate on exactly why they do choose to participate or don't want to participate or why they get back to us. At this time, Fonnie Willis, we are doing the Fulton County District Attorney debate, and Fonnie Willis is the only incumbent who has actually come out and declined to say that she will not be participating. We are also doing the Congressional District 6 with Lucy McBath, and we have not gotten a official response answer from her campaign. We are doing the District 13 Democratic debate that would include Congressman David Scott. We have not heard back from that campaign. And we are also doing the Georgia Supreme Court that would include Andrew Pinson. We are still have been in conversations with his campaign, but we, as of today, at this time, we don't have a response if he'll be participating or not.
Bill, you have moderated these debates many times before. You've been on the hot seat asking these other men and women to answer questions, push them to really get to where they are on these positions and even some of their backgrounds. What does it mean for a moderator if there's just an empty podium?
Well, obviously, it really means that your viewers, your listeners, have no opportunity to hear, particularly in this case, incumbents answer important questions, we hope important questions, about what they want to accomplish when they're in office. And it's an interesting balancing act. I mean, there have been arguments about debates and whether candidates should participate in them or not for many, many years at various levels. On one hand, you understand to some extent why a Lucy McBath, who is very well known, very well liked, has raised a ton of money compared to her opponents, why she feels as a candidate Why would I put myself in a position of being quizzed, put on the spot by my opponents, give them a chance to make an impression? The problem with that is she does have, I think, like all of these candidates, an obligation to speak out on the issues and for viewers to get a chance to hear what she says. It's a difference between running your campaign and the obligation to talk in a public forum.
Lori, how did the press club decide to put an empty podium there? It really speaks volumes for viewers when they see one candidate has shown up and is ready to take questions, and then in place of them, it's just air.
Yeah, it's always an interesting look on our debates when there is an empty podium, especially when we have these debates that are two candidates. So there's one candidate and one empty podium. But we've had this policy in place for many, many years because we decided it is not fair to the candidate who agrees to the invitation to debate. If their opponent doesn't, it's not fair to cancel the debate. Otherwise, we know no one would probably ever agree to debate, but we don't want to penalize the person that says, yeah, I will come and I will answer questions from the local media that's asking these questions.
So I had a chance to have a conversation with somebody who our listeners will certainly know, who was Michael Thurmond. He's currently the CEO of DeKalb County, but he was also the former labor commissioner here in the state of Georgia. And I believe this, it's now a tradition, this tradition of having an empty podium goes back to his race for labor commissioner when he decided to show up for his race. For his debate, rather, and his opponent did not. And Maria Saporta at the time said they used to just cancel the debates, but if it was just going to be one candidate, but they wanted to not be rewarding candidates for not showing up and penalizing the candidates who were willing to show up.
That is correct. And, you know, frankly, for the candidate that is there, it really gives them an opportunity. It's just all about them. And they get to do all the answering. And some of our candidates in the past have done a really great job of, for some, it's awkward if they're there just with an empty podium next to them. But others have done a really great job of highlighting their opponent who's not there. One of the debates that really comes to mind is when we had the December 2020, the Senate runoffs, and who was now Senator John Ossoff was debating against David Perdue, and David Perdue chose not to be there. And there's some great shots. John Ossoff really maximized the fact that his opponent was not there. And so some of these candidates really are able to maximize on that of, hey, I'm here and look who's not.
We could do a photo gallery of all the empty podiums over the years, Lori. But, you know, there's a lot to look forward to with the Sunday Atlanta Press Club debate because we're going to hear challengers make their cases. And in some cases, these are challengers that have little money to get their message out, who we really don't have visible campaigns. So we'll be able to hear their cases for why they should be taking on these incumbents. But also, Lori, we're going to get a great glimpse of the contenders of the wide open Georgia 3rd congressional district race, where there is a number of Republicans, and the biggest names in the Republican field are all planning to participate in that debate. So I'm really looking forward to watching that one in particular.
Yeah, we're very excited for that district. Every candidate who qualified to have their name on the ballot was invited to participate, and they all have said they will be there. And of course, that district is very conservative, so thought is that who wins this primary could very well be the next congressperson. So this will be an opportunity for voters to get to hear from all of these candidates on one stage to really compare and contrast who is running for that seat.
Bill?
I just want to point out that I feel it's unfortunate for the Atlanta Press Club that this is happening in this particular election cycle, as it has been in the past. Greg's a member of the committee. Lori, you work very, very hard on putting these debates together. These are wonderful civic forums in which people should be able to hear from their candidates. And over the years, the press club has been relentless in making them available and giving the public a chance to hear from all of the candidates. And so I think it's a shame if, in fact, these candidates who have already apparently decided not to debate continue that posture. The press club deserves better. And so do we as voters.
Thank you. And I will say all of you have been served as on our panels in the past, and we appreciate all of your past support. But we really do work hard to provide this equal opportunity. We want them to be very nonpartisan. We want the candidates to show up and know that they are all going to be treated equally and just have an opportunity to get their message out to the voters. As y'all said, for a lot of them, they don't get a lot of exposure if they're not the big front runners. And this really is a chance for them to show the public who they are. And we're very proud of what we do, and we hope this is not a trend with the incumbents choosing not to participate. We hope this is just kind of a primary little blip, but this public service has been very important to the Atlanta Press Club, and we look forward to continuing to offer it.
All right. Well, Lori, before we let you go, tell our audience how they can watch the debates either online or on television. How can they do it?
Yes. Thank you. I was going to put in that plug. So if you go to the AtlantaPressClub.org, you will see the full schedule of debates. We are doing 7 of them on this Sunday, and they are all going to be streaming live on the Atlanta Press Club Facebook page. They'll be streaming live on GPB.org. But afterwards, GPB and WABE, they are going to be airing many of the debates. And if you still don't get to see it from all of this time, then they will be available on demand on the Atlanta Press Club YouTube page. So we are offering a lot of opportunities for people to catch these debates before they go to the polls, so they are well prepared and know who they want to vote for.
Okay, great. Well, Lori Strauss with the Atlanta Press Club, thanks so much for being on today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Okay, guys, let's talk in some detail about these debates, who we're going to see and who we're not going to see. That 6th district, Greg, this is the newly formed 6th congressional district. It includes portions of Cobb County, portions of West Atlanta, and a little bit west of the city as well. We're going to have Jerrica Richardson, who is a current Cobb commissioner. State Representative Mandisha Thomas is also running. She'll also be at the debate, but Lucy McBath won't be at that debate.
Yeah, Patricia, this is the paradox of these debates, because of course, as journalists, we want to hear the candidates, the incumbents. Lucy McBath is not your average incumbent either, right? She has been drawn out of her district no less than 3 times. And so she is now fighting to represent a largely new district as well. And she's someone who could very well be a candidate for governor or other statewide office in the not so distant future. So she's not your average U.S. House member. So we want to hear from her. But at the same time, her opponents don't have don't even have enough money in their campaign coffers to buy a rusting 30-year-old Toyota Corolla. And so from their perspective, probably, it's, we're talking, $1,200.
How much does that cost? Her opponent says. Not much.
From the political aspect of it, they're like, well, why would we give, I'm sure they're thinking to themselves, why would we give our opponents a venue to bash and hammer us, right? Because even if Lucy does great, Representative McBath ends up, a 30-minute debate makes a number of points. If they get that one little, sidewinder in there that could be a social media clip, it can be used against her. And that's just how the nature of social media and the media world has changed since that moment that we talked about with Michael Thurmond. When social media was a little younger back then.
and so a lot of these
candidates and campaigns worry about that. But of course, from a voter's perspective and a Democratic perspective in the lowercase d, we want to hear those candidates get pressed on the key issues that they might not talk about in the halls of Congress to a group of mostly national reporters. We want to hear them on Georgia issues. We want to hear them on where they stand on some of the key debates in our ecosystem right now.
Well, yeah, it's also Well, I'm sorry, Patricia.
Oh, no. I was going to say, I totally get it. Like, I understand if I'm running a campaign, you're not doing that debate, Lucy McBeth, because you don't have to, really. People know who she is. They know what she stands for. But as a journalist and really as a voter myself, Bill, I want to see candidates out of perfectly controlled settings. Mm-hmm. I want to see how they respond, how they mix it up, how they are on their feet, and how they interact with people. You don't see that much anymore.
You just anticipated just what I wanted to add to the conversation. You know, a Lucy McBeth, a David Scott, their answer to this would be, well, we have town meetings. We talk to our constituents on somewhat of a regular basis, so they do hear how we stand on issues. But that's not the same, because in those situations, as you point out, Patricia, they're in control. They decide which issues they think their constituents will respond positively to and stay away from the ones that may be more problematic. In a debate with journalists asking questions, they're vulnerable to having to answer questions they may not be as comfortable with.
And to take it a step further, Patricia, we actually don't hear from some of these candidates that often. We don't hear from Congressman David Scott. He is notoriously hard to interview. There's valid questions about his health, and his opponents are trying to make that an issue in this race. And I know, Patricia, you had a hard time even figuring out who the right contact is to figure out whether he's going to debate or not at all.
Yeah, really strange situation. Of course, so I wrote a column about this. This is one of the reasons we're talking about this today. I wrote a column about this, and of course, I would reach out to all the candidates who are not coming. I reached out to the Scott campaign. Literally couldn't find anybody to talk to. Very strange. There's a sort of combination of paternity leave. There's a situation of the voicemail is on at the front office in Washington. Just a really unusual email's not returned. It's unusual. That's all I can say. Unusual to not get a response. But Bill.
Well, let me throw in. You also in that column pointed out the downsides of participating in a debate. You pointed to Kelly Loeffler's performance in her debate, in which she repeated the same phrase. You'll remember it. I don't off the top of my head. Over
radical
and over.
Liberal, radical liberal.
Oh, I remember it. We were there.
Yeah. And ad nauseum. And it hurt her. It clearly hurt her. So there is a downside.
Like, yeah. Greg, I totally agree. In a situation where not a lot of voters had seen Kelly Loeffler before, because she was very new, had been appointed, never ran for office, because she was appointed. So this was the first time people were seeing her on television or in any capacity. Radical liberal Raphael Warnock, obviously counseled by her campaign to repeat that over and over, but it really landed so flat it made national headlines the next day.
Yeah, I think she said that phrase 13 times, and I was a panelist on the debate. Patricia, I think you were covering it for the AJC that day. And, you know, of course, at that moment, the big question was, you know, where she stood on Donald Trump. Donald Trump was saying the election was lying and promoting conspiracy theories about the election fraud in 2020 and all that. And we were pressing her on a number of those issues, and the answer kept on going back to radical liberal Raphael Warnock. But I will say, you know, in a very candid postmortem, even weeks later, a lot of the people around her said that that is exactly what they wanted, because they got the sound clips that they needed for their ads, because they were not trying to appeal to moderate, middle-of-the-road swing voters who are undecided. They were trying to get out the Donald Trump MAGA base again in that runoff.
Okay, so they're not sorry. They're not sorry they did that. A fun fact, that was the most watched Atlanta Press Club debate of all time, because it was such a high-profile race. Control of the Senate was on the line. More than 3 million people watched that, because it was also simulcast by Fox, CNN, and I believe ABC News. It was just that important of a Senate race. Well, Bill, now getting back to some of these races and some of the debates coming up on Sunday, we were getting to this, but Congressman David Scott has not responded, and so we assume he will not be at that debate. At the debate will be Marcus Flowers, who people may remember as being the opponent of Marjorie Taylor Greene in the 14th Congressional District in 2022. He raised $14 million, did not win and has now decided, he has not actually moved, but he has decided now to challenge Congressman Scott in this Democratic primary.
Yeah, he, of course, Marcus Flowers got an enormous amount of national attention when he challenged Marjorie Taylor Greene because of the extraordinary amount of money he was able to raise from people who didn't apparently across the country get just how red that district really is and how vulnerable, how flawed in some ways a candidate Marcus Flowers may have been. This time, he's in a much different situation. It seems that he's raised all that money in one race. It's not going so well for him here. He's raised very little money in this one. But I do think Greg made an important point. There have been a lot of people wondering about David Scott's stamina, his health. He's how old is he at this point? He's in his late 70s too, right? Like Donald Trump, am I right? Or Joe Biden, am I right about that?
He's definitely in his 70s.
Okay, so you know, the fact that he will not show up to debate is going to give his opponents a chance to talk about whether he has at least the stamina to continue in his job. But it also, it means that we don't get a chance to see him perhaps at his best, perhaps firing on all cylinders and being terrific.
Yeah, he's 78 years old. And guys, switching topics a little bit here too, I'm also interested in these down ticket races where you don't hear much about these contests. And one of the ones, and it's super, you know, it's hugely important, is the Georgia Supreme Court race. That involves former Congressman John Barrow, a Democrat, who of course is running as nonpartisan in a nonpartisan race, against incumbent Justice Andrew Pinson, who was put on the bench not long ago by Governor Brian Kemp. And John Barrow is trying to make this race about abortion rights. Andrew Pinson is saying he can't participate in the debate because certain judicial rules that forbid him from debating about issues that might come before the bench. We know that judges in the past have participated in these debates, and we do know that these are justices that will take up some of the most important issues that before Georgia voters over the next few years.
Yeah, Bill, that Georgia Supreme Court takes up hugely, hugely important issues, and especially because a number of issues are coming through the legislature instead of through Congress. Abortion, immigration, things we typically think of as federal decisions, really are very likely at some point to end up at the state Supreme Court. And because Pinson has never been elected, again, he was appointed, voters have really never heard much from him. So they would like a chance to see him before this race, because May is the only election for this race. This is a nonpartisan race. There will be no race in November. So this is the time to be voting on the Georgia State Supreme Court. Andrew Pinson's campaign has said they're still trying to work out a format where he wouldn't potentially violate the code of conduct that has been established for Supreme Court justices. But John Barrow disagrees with that premise entirely and said that Pinson should be debating and can be debating and just doesn't want to debate.
Yeah, well, of course, the Pinson campaign knows something else that's very important in this setting as well, and that is that in races involving judges, incumbent behind the name is the biggest driver of why people cast the ballot the way they do, because most voters pay very little attention to judicial races one way or the other. So Heath Garrett, who's running that campaign, you're right, he told you, against Patricia, that they were looking for some way to do it. But they also get that the eye is a big factor in his reelection. Why risk losing because he has to answer questions he doesn't want to talk about?
Okay, Greg, let's talk our last incumbent, who is not expected, is probably the most famous incumbent in Georgia right now, perhaps other than Governor Brian Kemp, is District Attorney Fani Willis here in Fulton County. She does have both a primary election in May as well as a general election coming up in November. But she's got a Democratic opponent in Christian Wise Smith. The Willis campaign has told us that a little bit like Judge Pinson, just because a number of the things that she's dealing with right now are a matter of ongoing litigation and are worried about running afoul of saying something in a debate, being asked something about a debate related to either the Trump case or the Young Thug case that could then be used as a challenge in court. So that is the reason we're understanding that Willis is not planning to come on Sunday.
Yeah, and she said that in a statement to you and to our colleague Shannon McCaffrey. So she's the lone incumbent of this group that has actually said I'm not going to participate in the debate. And of course, there were stories written about that after she said that. But look, it's true. You know, everything she says in a debate will be scrutinized by the defendants in both those cases you just mentioned, the Trump case, the YSL case, and, you know, or will be fodder for attacks, not just in court, but on social media. We've already seen Trump and his allies try to paint her as a politicized prosecutor who's weaponizing the justice system against a former president. But also, you know, of course, Patricia, she spends a lot of time already in front of the cameras. Every time there's an event, you know, she seems to give interviews. It's not like she has not spoken publicly about these many issues to the media before. And her opponent, Christian Weiss Smith, is not directly bringing up the Trump case. He is actually trying to make the argument that he would bring sort of more progressive ideologies and theories and handling of the justice system. And so ostensibly the debate would be a lot less about Trump and YSL and more about just the handling of the jail backlog and other issues.
Bill, did you have anything to add on that?
No, I just wonder if Fani Willis has some legitimate point here. Judge McAfee has already reprimanded her for her speech at Big Bethel Church when she defended her conduct in the Trump prosecution, and we know that the Trump lawyers would love her to talk as much as possible because they think it's going to weaken her ability to prosecute them legitimately. So I can't help but wonder if she's kind of in a tough spot in terms of how to proceed with this, but I'm assuming that there are rules that could be put in place that would give her the freedom to talk about some matters and not others. But I do sort of understand it's a little awkward for a Fani Willis right now.
Yeah, a looming gag order makes you not want to mix it up on stage, on live TV, probably. I've never been in that situation, but I assume that's how she's feeling right now. Okay, well, as Lori Strauss said, you can go to gpb.org or the Atlanta Press Club's website to find out more about when you can watch these either live on stream or when they'll be broadcast on GPB. So y'all can go to the website and find out more about that. All right, we're going to leave that conversation there. When we come back, State Representative Syra Draper will join us. She'll be talking about upcoming changes to election laws and a new tool that has her worried about what could happen next. This is Politically Georgia from the AJC.
Ocean breeze, tropical beach. An air freshener can make your car smell like paradise. A drive to Daytona Beach will actually get you there. Beach on. Plan your trip today at DaytonaBeach.com.
Welcome back to Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Twice daily, delivered straight to your email, you can receive the AJC's Politically Georgia newsletter. Stay on top of all of the important news, scoops, and exclusives from me and the rest of the AJC's politics team. Just go to ajc.com/newsletters and sign up today. Well, now we want to welcome to the show State Representative Syra Draper and here to join us for a conversation about upcoming changes to election law. Representative Draper, thanks for coming back.
Hi, it's so great to be back.
Thank you. Thank you. So the session is over. A number of changes to election law have passed and will soon be signed into law if they haven't already. But one of those that we have heard from you, we know you're concerned about, is this change to mass challenges to voter registration. Tell us a little bit about which law you've got concerns about and why you're worried.
Okay, well, thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about this because, in general, I just don't think it's something that's being talked about enough. But I think it is going to be an absolutely massive issue as we get closer to November and the presidential election. And so you touched on it. We're talking about mass voter challenges. And we actually saw mass voter challenges in the weeks before the 2021 Ossoff-Warnock runoff. In the weeks before that runoff election, a group out of Texas called True the Vote filed over 360,000 challenges against Georgia voters, basically questioning their eligibility to vote, to even participate in the election. And that was done so shoddily and so last minute that the overwhelming majority of those 360,000 voter challenges were eliminated, were kicked out, were never processed, and those voters were not affected. But there were a few voters who were affected. Nevertheless, that kind of set this precedent for a process of filing what I refer to as mass meritless voter challenges that have damaging effects on our election systems and very much chill voters and scare them from coming to vote and have them questioning and confused about their eligibility to participate in the process. In the years since then, we have seen the mass voter challenge process abused. We have seen thousands of challenges filed, and I would say across Georgia, but it really hasn't been across Georgia. The latest iteration of these challenges have been very much focused in Democratic-rich counties. So counties like Fulton, Gwinnett, DeKalb County, Cobb County. We're also seeing it in large counties that are Republican, majority Republican, but have large numbers of Democrats, like Forsyth County, Fayette County. So they're very much being targeted against Democratic voters. And again, we have seen many of these challenges, if not most of these challenges, just out because they're meritless. There's not enough evidence there to suggest that these voters aren't eligible to vote. But what happens is when a county receives hundreds or thousands of challenges at a time, they have to stop everything they're doing, right? Registering voters, going through paperwork, sending out the absentee ballots, all the things that they have to do to make elections run. They have to stop that and they have to deal with the challenge. And that's a pretty devastating effect.
Representative Draper, I'm glad you mentioned that point because that's exactly the issue we heard from Democrats and from election staffers doing debate over this issue in hearings and other venues, was that even if they're meritless, even if they're not successful, even if the vast majority are thrown out in states like Georgia and beyond, it ties up the resources of already overworked election staffers who are literally the cogs of our democracy in Georgia.
Yes, they are very much forced to stop what they're doing, process the challenges. It puts them behind. And what's really alarming and what I want to talk about today is the fact that the GOP-dominated legislature has passed bills to make the process of voter challenges easier. So rather than protecting our election officials, who are democracy heroes, rather than protecting the voters who want to participate in the process, they are doing the opposite. They are passing legislation to welcome additional voter challenges and, in fact, make it more likely that the voter challenges are going to be accepted and people will be kicked off the rolls.
So, Representative Draper, this ability to have mass voter challenges at the click of a mouse button is clearly something it's aimed at suppressing, as you pointed out, you think Democratic votes. But a lot of legislation, I'd love to ask you about other things. A lot of it this year was focused on election operations and management, correct? Aside from this big mass cancellation possibility. So I'd love to ask you about a couple of the other measures. The elimination of voting booths in some precincts. One way to look at that is to say, well, that's going to make for longer lines in some precincts. It might discourage people from casting a ballot. But we also hear from some election officials in probably smaller counties that they don't want to go through to the expense of all these machines. Do you see that as being an effort to suppress voters? The elimination of QR codes, which won't happen for this upcoming election, are these issues that are more management-oriented and not particularly detrimental to the ability to cast ballots, or do you think they have an impact?
So those are two very different issues, right? And I think we need to deal with them one by one. So there was a provision that was passed that basically says you don't have to have as many. It doesn't require as many voting booths at the precinct as it did before. And I think that is actually fine. That was a provision that was led by election officials. Mm-hmm. who were under the law for a couple years, and they said, hey, we actually don't need this many voting booths. We don't have lines. And by the way, where we do have lines, it's at the check-in stage. It's not at the voting booth stage. And what you're basically making these election workers do is put out a lot of additional heavy equipment that isn't needed. So to scale back on that, I think that's totally fine. And I just really appreciate, again, that that decision was led by our election officials, as opposed to our legislators who want to decide policy from the floor. So that one is fine. With respect to the QR code, that is something that's not going to be implemented this year. And that's because there's a technical reason for that. We do not have the equipment to read a ballot without the QR code at this time. And so, you know, this legislation was passed. I view it as somewhat performative, because without the over hundreds of millions of dollars of additional equipment that we would need to purchase in order to read our ballots as they are without a QR code, that bill does nothing. Does it make some people feel better to say that we're going to take out the QR codes? It probably does. But until we make that huge additional investment, we won't actually be able to implement that bill.
A quick follow-up to that one. It may not take effect, and it may be meaningless at this point, but it does contribute to a Republican effort to cast suspicion on whether your ballot is being counted accurately or not. Yes?
Yeah, no, it sure does. When we undermine confidence in our elections, we have seen the devastating effects of people intentionally undermining confidence in our elections. And, you know, I would just warn Republicans, we saw what happened in the Georgia runoffs when President Trump was touting that the elections weren't working and they were rigged. It caused a huge a lot of Republicans didn't return to the polls to vote in the runoff. So I know there is a theory of the case that if we undermine our elections, that it's going to try to turn out, but it impacts all turnout. So I think that's something that politicians really need to be wary about. Getting back to this voter challenge issue, SB 189, which is the bill that we passed on literally the very last day of session, it didn't hit our desks until after 8 p.m. on the last day of session, which if you look at that big picture, this is a major election overhaul bill in a presidential election year. Shouldn't we have more time to grapple with these major issues? But setting that aside, it really paves the way for more voter challenges. And I think we need to look at that in context with a new software that Republicans are pushing out this year. There is a software called Eagle Eye. It's Eagle spelled AI. The I is spelled AI. And it is a software that is going to allow a person with a couple clicks of a mouse to file mass voter challenges. So essentially, it's going to make a process that's already really easy even easier to do. So when you couple the existence of this software with legislation like SB 189 that invites voter challenges, that makes it easier, that makes it more likely that people are going to be kicked off the rolls, we really have a perfect storm.
Let's talk a little bit more about that. So I know you've never filed a mass voter challenge, but how would you do this? How would somebody take this software? Are they just going to click on a county, click on names? How do you imagine they would use that? And then what happens on the other end? What if you're a voter whose name gets swept up into this process?
Yeah. So when you're putting a voter challenge together, you have to identify the voters that you are challenging. You have to provide evidence for why you are challenging them. So it's somewhat a time intensive, paper intensive, laborious process. What Eagle AI does is, or Eagle Eye, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, honestly, it really streamlines that document gathering, evidence gathering process so that yes, it automates the package for you and sends it directly to the appropriate county official for challenging. Now, when you're on the other side of that, as a person who has been challenged, actually, let me step back. The county, when they receive the challenge, they have to process that challenge within 10 days. So they don't have a lot of discretion about when they can challenge it. If they're in the heat of processing absentee ballots, they need to stop what they're doing. And they need to process these challenges. And they have to send out notices to every single person who is challenged. And then they have to hold a hearing.
Representative Draper, Governor Kemp still hasn't signed this measure into law. He's a former Secretary of State. He's a former top elections official. He's very familiar with these issues. Oftentimes, you're on the opposite sides of these issues. You and the governor. In this case, though, we've heard from senior Republicans who suspect he might not sign this measure into law, in part because it creates a real time crunch for state elections officials to get people on the ballot to make some of these changes in time for this election. What are you hearing from in conservative circles about some skepticism over this measure?
You know, yeah, you're right. It hasn't been signed yet. I have heard those same rumors. Look, I'd be thrilled if this wasn't signed. I think from a legal perspective, there's a lot of reasons why a passage of a bill like this might undermine existing litigation that the state is currently in. So there's a lot of legal rationale behind why they wouldn't want to sign this bill. That being said, you know, elections and voting and challenges and the cleaning of the rolls, quote unquote, is such a triggering issue. And there would be a lot of political fallout if he were to veto this bill. So I'm not holding my breath.
Okay, well, we're going to keep a very close eye on the bills, of course, that Governor Kemp is signing. And then if he does sign this, Representative Draper, I hope you'll keep monitoring it very carefully and come back and tell us what you're seeing, if there are mass voter challenges that have you worried, anything else that you think our audience ought to know about this situation. If you will monitor it, we would love to have you back.
Yeah, and I think there'll be a lot of organizing efforts about reaching out to voters who have been challenged to let them know that, you know, it's not anything that they have done, it's not their fault, that more than likely they're still eligible to vote. So there's going to be a lot of effort and resources expended to helping these people have the right that they a fundamental right that should be theirs, but is being challenged at every turn.
Okay, great. Well, listen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right, still to come, Fannie Willis is no longer the only state prosecutor to bring election interference charges against Donald Trump's allies. We'll take a look at the indictments filed yesterday against Trump electors in Arizona. This is Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome back to Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. The AJC has a special offer for Politically Georgia podcast listeners. If you subscribe today, you can get 3 months of unlimited digital access for just 99 cents. That's all of our breaking news, politics, investigations, business, sports, food and dining, and so much more. Plus access to our e-paper, the AJC app, and our assortment of newsletters, of course, including the Politically Georgia newsletter. So take advantage of this special offer for podcast listeners only by going to ajc.com/starta. That's ajc.com/starta. This is an introductory special offer for new subscribers only. Well, guys, we got a couple minutes left, and let's talk about a very big story that has happened out in Arizona. Bill, there have been a number of indictments out in Arizona over a situation very similar to what we saw here in Georgia with the Trump electors who cast their electoral votes for President Trump. It really looks familiar, and now it looks like the prosecution looks pretty familiar too. Tell us what happened.
Well, it's the fourth swing state in which there have been criminal charges filed against not just Trump electors. In three of the states, Michigan, Nevada, and Georgia, we know that Trump electors have been charged with criminal offenses. Here in Georgia, of course, we also have charges against Donald Trump himself, Mark Meadows, Rudolph Giuliani, and the others. But Arizona is the first state to join Georgia in not just indicting the Trump electors, but also indicting Giuliani, Meadows, Boris Epstein, a close advisor to Trump, for the first time is subject to indictment. So yes, Arizona and Georgia stand alone in indicting those high-level Trump allies on criminal charges.
Greg, you wrote the all-important lead of the Politically Georgian newsletter today about this very issue. And I'm only laughing because you do it so often. So we appreciate your work on the newsletter, Greg. But so you wrote the lead today about the Arizona case. What jumped out to you when you saw these charges coming down?
Yeah, well, one was the surprise. I mean, a lot of folks, I don't know about in Arizona, but a lot of folks beyond Arizona were caught off guard by the Attorney General's announcement that there was this sweeping grand jury indictment against a number of Trump allies. But the big other part is Donald Trump himself was not indicted in Arizona. He is listed as an unindicted co-conspirator, which generally means he could end up getting indicted. Mm-hmm. There are a number of unindicted co-conspirators in the Georgia case. I think there's dozens of them in the Georgia case, if I remember correctly, which means there's always a chance of a superseding indictment, a later indictment that ends up nabbing some more people. But as Bill mentioned, you know, there's overlap, but then there's not overlap. There's overlap with Mark Meadows, with John Eastman, with Jenna Ellis, with Rudy Giuliani, but then there's a couple, and with Mike Roman, there's a couple new names, though. Boris Epstein's one of them, and Christina Bob, another attorney for Donald Trump, who is involved in the aftermath of 2020, is another one. So there are some very familiar threads here with the Republican electors and with names like Giuliani, and there's some unfamiliar threads here. And we're going to be really closely watching here in Georgia how that case plays out, because you know we have this huge head start in Georgia, but yet there's still not even a trial date, and it's still up in the air how quickly this Arizona case moves. But there's a chance it could start getting more traction quicker than Georgia's case could.
Chris May is the Democratic Attorney General of Arizona who impaneled this grand jury. It's interesting in the indictment that he doesn't name Mark Meadows or Rudolph Giuliani specifically. That'll, of course, come to light later. But he refers to, in one case, a gentleman often known as the mayor, which clearly is Giuliani, and then talks about the President Trump's chief of staff in 2020, which clearly is Mark Meadows, but they're not named by name specifically in the indictment. But it is fascinating that Mays decided not to go after Donald Trump specifically. And you're right, Greg, there could be a superseding indictment, but you've got to wonder to what extent Mays watched what's going on with Fulton County and wondered if he wanted that trouble at this moment.
Yeah, Bill, and there's the fact there's already four other criminal jurisdictions, criminal charges pending against Donald Trump. So maybe he thought, okay, we can always come back to that later. And also, look, the same sort of attacks that were leveled against Fannie Willis are now being leveled at that attorney general in Arizona and others who he's associated with. We already have a statement from Georgia GOP chair Josh McCoon, who's been on the show several times, saying that he's disgusted to hear of another Democratic prosecutor putting the party first over the country, trying to criminalize the lawful contest of an election. Patricia, that is just a taste of what's to come. You know, anyone in Georgia knows what Fannie Willis and others who have taken up cases against Donald Trump and his allies have faced, because they're about to get an onslaught in Arizona.
Yes, well, we certainly saw the full court press against Fannie Willis, so much so that now she has lost her special prosecutor on that case and needed to replace him because of the challenges filed from a number of the defendants after really going through with a fine-tooth comb everything that they knew about Fannie Willis and every investigator on that case so far. So, Bill, I wonder if it even makes a difference in terms of the perception of this Arizona case that Donald Trump is not on the list of specific people being indicted, because it is still a Trump-related case. It still was related to Donald Trump trying to overturn that election in Arizona, as he did here in Georgia. Certainly, much of this was done with his knowledge in many cases. But I guess my question right now is, for Donald Trump himself, He's in court in New York today. He is so getting wound around the axle of all of these court cases. I wonder for voters if they have the bandwidth to pay attention to another court case related to the 2020 election and Donald Trump and more trouble that he and his team are in, or if this all just starts to run together and either you believe Trump and his denials or you don't.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think we already know that for Trump's base, they're with him. They're not concerned about right now the details of these cases, although polling does show that there are people outside of that hardcore base whose vote might change against Trump if he's convicted on any of these charges. But I think you're right. They all sort of swim together for all of, I mean, how often do we have to stop all of us and think, now wait, Jack Smith has the case in Washington, and they've also got the case in Florida. I mean, we're all having to kind of keep these straight in our heads.
But Greg, for our purposes as reporters and journalists, do you think that there are going to be clues in the documents from Arizona that could inform what we already know about what happened here in Georgia?
There could be, and that's why we're watching so closely what could come out of that. It's also going to be interesting to see why they decided in Arizona not to go after certain. Remember, our indictment in Georgia was 19 in all, including Donald Trump. So why they decided not to include some of the folks who were indicted in Georgia, but also indicted Epstein and Christina Bob in that case. But there's also going to be, it'll also be interesting to see how many unindicted co-conspirators beyond Donald Trump that are named, because in Georgia there are dozens, and many of the names that we know very well here in Georgia, they decided not to charge.
Okay, so here's pure speculation. If Donald Trump is not one of the indicted defendants in this Arizona case, can they, in fact, get that case up and running well before the election? And if Mark Meadows and Rudolph Giuliani are defendants in the case, as they are, then certainly one of the things prosecutors are going to introduce into evidence is the famous meeting in the Oval Office, which Donald Trump sat in on, in which the entire Trump elector scheme was hatched. So whether he's indicted in this case or not, news will start getting out if it's possible this case could go before the election about Trump's involvement in that sense. I think that's another interesting scenario. I have no idea whether it's realistic or not.
Well, Bill, there's nothing I love more than informed speculation. And that's what I'm going to classify that as. Well, we're going to find out the answer to that mystery and many others as this, as both that case goes forward, as the 2024 elections get closer, and as all of this continues, a situation where one is informing the outcome of the other. Well, we're almost out of time, but if you've got a question for the show, you can call the Politically Georgia mail-in hotline anytime. Leave a message and we'll play it back and answer it on our Friday listener mailbag segment. That number is 770-810-5297. That's 770-810-5297. And that's all the time we have for today's podcast. You can now hear Politically Georgia on 90.1 WABE right here in Atlanta on weekdays at 10, or follow Politically Georgia, as you know, on your favorite podcast app, and you'll hear new episodes every afternoon. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review. It really helps us grow the show, and share Politically Georgia with a friend. Join us again tomorrow for Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Ocean breeze, tropical beach, piña colada. You can buy an air freshener to make your car smell like you're in an oceanside paradise. Or, better yet, you can point your car toward Daytona Beach and come experience the real thing. Visit DaytonaBeach.com to discover all there is to see, do, and enjoy along the world's most famous beach, Daytona Beach, Florida. Beach on.
In Atlanta, one voice has stood out for over four decades. An AJC original, The Monica Pearson Show.
Let Let's talk about how you got to ESPN.
Revealing interviews.
You are known as America's doctor, but I want to know who you were before that.
When you have a different name, you have different color skin, it can be tough.
With Atlanta's most famous faces as you've never seen them before.
I'm telling my story. This is the American dream.
The Monica Pearson Show, streaming now on AJC.com.